right. No, no, dude. Hello, nah. Everybody. Welcome back to the Chilluminati podcast. I don't know why you said that right before we started. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by Sora and Sora, mm-mm, Alex and Jesse.
No, don't. I don't want to be involved in that. I'm all right.
For 1 second. That's the real mystery. That's the real conspiracy theory. That's the at the end of all of this, you're going to find out that every mysterious thing that I've done on the show was to train you to finally comprehend the plot of Kingdom Hearts, and you're going to be like, oh, you're going to be like Hugh Jackman in that one shot.
And Tree of Life or whatever?
Yeah, like, Tree of Life. Or you're going to be like Willem Dafoe in that other shot.
You know, yeah.
From the lighthouse?
All those shots.
Very, very timely song reference.
I figured I'm going with what you would know. And you did.
Yeah, so I appreciate frankly, that. Right. I did know. Yeah. I did know. You're right. You're completely correct.
You got to know your audience, dude.
You know what I'm saying? What would Mathis know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a rule of thumb for like never being misunderstood and with a cultural reference is like you got to aim for Mathis's like level of like movie knowledge or like cultural knowledge.
I'm sorry. I lower the bar for what is
the bar. You don't lower the bar. You make it okay for people to not have to ask the question.
All right, I'll wear it that way.
You're out there.
Yeah,
in a way,
you're
a hero. You know what I mean?
You know what? You're right. I am.
That's certainly
I'm kind of like a hero.
Yeah.
I'm like the embodiment of hope.
Yep.
You're the embodiment of hoping that you watch more movies. Yeah.
And I did. I watched Backrooms last week. I'm going to watch Disclosure Day next week.
I can make you a list of like 25 movies that you could watch, and then your life would change. You would never have that experience again of like
that's it 25 movies.
I think that's all it is. Like as somebody who worked at Blockbuster Video for a long fucking time, I think I could hit that list.
I like that. That's
it
your
seem like you've seen every movie.
All right, go ahead and whip me up 25 movies and watch me change in real time.
Watch yourself change. Listen to your heart. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Watch
I try
yourself change, dude.
Watch movies and pop culture change my operating brain and my working knowledge at any given moment for references.
Yep.
Listen, it is a bummer that I miss out on some references. Just like it's a bummer if you miss out on all the stuff selling at theyeti.com/Chilluminati because
oh my God.
He's making plays. This guy's taking chances.
Dude, how many posters are sold out now? We've lost we're running out of
posters. I
don't know.
I haven't looked recently, guys, but we did sell out of at least one.
Our comic book cover prints are 70% off. That's enough of an excuse to buy them all. All right. That's a good, if you were like, I want to have the like gallery of these, like they're really nice. And they're at theyeti.com/Chilluminati. That's with two E's in Yeti and no pod at the end of Chilluminati. It's a hard one to find, but you got it. It's going to be in the show.
Yeah, we believe in you.
We're having a spring cleaning sale. All the posters are going to go. And to celebrate spring, we also have a brand new growth. We've got the new Manted and Chill shirt from Mel. It's fucking beautiful. It's a sexy Manted with four arms. Nice. It's riding a rocket ship. Who could ask for anything more? And then we also have Mudsley's top secret stickers, which you can only see before you buy if you head to our members only free patreon.com/Chilluminati pod, where even the free folks, even people who are just there to find out the stickers. I just want you
to free membership stuff that you still get over there.
Yeah. But Mudsley, you should buy Mudsley stickers with every purchase that you make in the shop because half of the proceeds go straight to Mudsley because we're going to pay them exactly all our artists. We're paying them exactly like
50 cents.
Like 50-50. It's like real. It's not
almost
like
a dollar.
We're giving them like $200 at the top and then being like, thank you. We're going to, you know, we're older. We've seen how this industry chews people up.
Older, wiser.
Get money for every guy you sell. It's tight.
Yeah, it's true.
It's tight.
Just how do I take out a go from that to where we're about to go?
That's on you, man. That's a you problem.
Smitty's trying to help. He's doing his best to break
the
tension.
Oh, God, don't do it.
He's warning us not to do it. You know, they made it. Jesse and Alex, you both made a fantastic point before we were recording that I should have put a trigger warning at the beginning of episode one because we dove into the murders kind of immediately.
Yeah.
consider this a retroactive trigger warning for episode one.
Oh my gosh, look, he's flying into the air. Oh, look, he's in that orbit of Earth. Oh, he's going around the Earth in the opposite direction.
Counterclockwise.
Oh my god, all the...
He knows this reference.
Like, chasms are closing up or whatever.
The 1970s Superman, he gets. Okay.
I do understand that reference. I got that one.
Who knows? WWK MK.
And time isn't real anyway, so who gives a shit?
Yeah, dude, we solved it. He did do a trigger warning last time. Joke's on you guys.
Joke's on you. A trigger warning for this episode as well, though way less of a degree than the first episode because we kind of formatted this with the murders heavily front-loaded. But today, we're going to go ahead and take that tangent and move and segue into part two of the Boston Strangler / Stranglers with the S in parentheses.
The bogeyman that's actually just like a few similar crimes.
Stranglers with an S.
Like,
right.
Like last week, we kind of left you boys with like a little problem. The idea that for 60-ish years, what are you
Sorry, there's
about?
Some implication now that there's stranglers with a Z. And those are the cool
I'm sure
ones.
There is. I'm sure there is. Yeah.
That's the cool guy.
You think that's what it's like? Out of the knot. You think it's like... when one strangler dies, another one like
rises to take his place. Yeah, yeah. It's apprentice. Learning,
but they always like have to Zorro. Say with a Z. Like, we're the Stranglers with a Z. Yeah.
Antonio Banderas.
They're like, they put down some cardboard and they start like breakdancing.
Yes, dancing. Yeah. They break dance. They like to strangle the pavement, if you know what I mean.
Oh, damn. I don't know exactly what you mean, but I'll extend you the poetic license.
Thank you.
To say.
Yeah, no. I mean, like, you should, though. Like, you should.
Yeah. Yeah. I will.
You should know.
Yeah.
All right, Smitty. I know too, dude. I know too. He's very excitable today. Well, we left off last week saying basically for almost 60 years at this point, everybody in America has mostly known that the Boston Strangler is singular. One man that we left off last week talking about, Albert DeSalvo was his name. And he confessed. He's the one that confessed in the insane asylum. He's the one Tony Curtis plays in the movie. Like, it's basically what everybody believes to be the true story.
Let's face it. Mm. I did it. And I loved doing it. And I do it again, every single one. And then it's like, you've confessed to 16 more than there were. And he's like, well, goodbye.
I am the Boston Strangler. And then he leaves. But that's kind of like in that joke, there is like a lot of truth because like we'll talk about it this episode. But we spent an entire episode talking about how this case was broken down. Cambridge cops, Boston detectives, lawyers, medical examiners, all that stuff. And almost to a man, every single one of them told you the same damn thing by the end of the episode. Sergeant James McDonald said, quote, Albert DeSalvo did none of the Boston stranglings, nor any of the others. While Police Commissioner Edmund McNamara said, quote, I knew there was more than one killer the whole time. We talked about the cops themselves.
They like
internally.
Laughed.
Yeah. We're like, yeah. They were like, we knew. We always knew. But they never pinned it on. They never caught multiple people. They just took Albert DeSalvo and put him in. And that's where we're going to find ourselves tonight. The man the entire world knows as the Boston Strangler. The men who hunted the Boston Strangler don't believe he was the Boston Strangler. And then we're going to look at, did he actually kill anybody at all, or was he entirely innocent from the get-go? Because there is a case to be made that he actually did commit one singular murder out of all of these murders, and that one murder is the reason he admitted to all the other murders for a very bizarre kind of, like, reason, which we'll talk about towards the end.
There's something. Isn't there a term for, like, the desire to be... Like almost kind of like what's his name who shot John Lennon, where he's like trying to insert himself into the
It's called being pathetic.
No, I swear there's like some cool Mindhunter ass word for it that
there
like
probably is. Someone who just like they want famous. The attention. Yeah, that's exactly where Albert DeSalvo is kind of
attention whore.
I would say slots. Yeah, attention whore, mediocre, whore, yeah. Like criminally mediocre.
That sounds like Mindhunter.
And that's kind of who this guy was. Like we're gonna go over today how an entire confession got built out of this dude who at the end of the day actually couldn't tell you how many days in June there were, but he had a perfect memory for every crime he ever committed.
Okay. All right, just for the record.
I'm not exaggerating, by the way.
Let's not crucify people for not knowing how many days are in June, because let me tell you, I'm going to be honest.
No, it's not about that. It's just about...
Let me just be honest. I got no fucking idea. May and June and July fuck me up every single time. Maybe I'm the Boston Strangler. I don't know. But if I am, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to everyone.
I'm sorry, too, if you are. That's unfortunate realization.
Yeah, that would not be helpful to this podcast, that's for sure.
Maybe for one episode. It would blow up a single episode, and then our podcast would
be a hell of an interview. Like, how did you do all that, dude?
Yeah.
If I'm responsible for one of the things that we cover on this show, it's not the Boston Strangler.
Thank you so much to Cash App for sponsoring today's episode. And all right, you all know I keep the money stuff pretty simple. And Cash App's been my go-to for years. Splitting a tab with friends or family, sending money to people who I know need it for the never-ending pet supply run. One tap and it's done with Cash App. Quick thing though, you can actually customize your Cash App card if you get one. And I've been sitting here thinking about what I'd put on mine. I'm landing on a little gray alien, obviously, but I don't know. It's something about making Alex or Jesse the face of my card that's really tempting. Anyway, here's the thing. If you weren't up to speed already, Cash App is way more than just a safe way to send and receive money. With the Cash App card, you unlock tons of perks without all the hidden fees. Enjoy benefits like exclusive early access to nationwide concert pre-sales, plus discounts on everyday purchases and popular brands you're probably already spending money on, to be honest. Add your card to your digital wallet to make your money moves so much easier. Cash App also adds security to your money by declining suspicious card transactions and sending you a notification to make sure the payment is really you. If your card is ever lost or stolen, you can lock it with just one tap right in the app. Spend with confidence with the Cash App card today. New Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use code CASHAPP10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners, prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC, Cash App Visa debit flex cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC, and the Bancorp Bank NA, pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc. See terms and conditions for the Sutton prepaid card, Sutton debit flex card, and Bancorp debit flex card. Cash App green features, savings, direct deposit roundups, overdraft coverage, and discounts provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures.
You heard it. You heard it here first.
All right. All right. It's a whole ARG for the audience to figure out.
I wish it was, but you know what? I've discovered after many years of trying, they just don't care that much. They just want to feel like they're solving an ARG. Yeah.
Well, on that, keeping in mind who talking about, we're going to break down who Albert DeSalvo is. So we're going to actually start where we kind of always start with an episode one in a true crime episode. Albert Henry DeSalvo himself, where he was born, etc. He was born in Chelsea, Massachusetts on September 3rd, 1931, and he was the third of six kids. And much like we've seen with basically every true crime episode we've ever done, if you want to understand the man, you have to understand the house that built him.
You have to find at what age he got hit really hard
in the head. well, let me tell you.
Do you have before we move on, do you have any like insider intel on like living nearby that about Chelsea?
Chelsea was too. I never really went to Chelsea as a kid. It was a little too far away for me. So no, nothing about Chelsea. I know of it, but that's it.
Does it have a reputation? Is it a nice place in your mind?
I think it's a nice place, but I don't. There's no reputation that I know of.
Vibes.
So we have to understand where this dude came from, and we have gone through a lot of horrific childhoods on this show. Albert's is one of the worst. He certainly had one of the worst childhoods. His father, Frank DeSalvo, was a fisherman and a machinist. He was also a monster. And like,
that's a bad combo, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a triple threat.
Triple threat. He's a fisherman, machinist, and monster. Frank would beat Albert's mother, Charlotte, and all six of his kids with his fists, with belts, and with pipes. He once pulled a gun. Yep. Like with a metal pipe. He once pulled a gun on his wife, Charlotte. And on another occasion, he took Charlotte's fingers and snapped them one at a time.
What?
Backwards, like dry twigs. So that hit for a second.
Don't like that.
Yeah. And it somehow kind of gets worse. Albert claimed his father once sold him and his sisters to a farmer up in Maine for $9.
Pardon?
And then they lived there for the rest of their lives, or?
Clearly not, because they grew up in the house.
Well,
they probably didn't go through.
Yeah.
They just didn't go through. His mother probably stopped them. Frank also would bring home prostitutes and have sex with them right in front of his kids. And on top of all that, he personally taught Albert how to shoplift. Like a little 1930. He was born in 1931.
Did he have rooms in his house?
I mean, yeah, but it was six kids, so they did a lot of sharing rooms. God. And like, if you're wondering, like, did Albert embellish any of this origin story and stuff, which, you know, you would assume maybe he did. It would be very on brand for him too. His younger brother, Richard, actually backs all of this up, and some of Richard's clearest memories of his entire childhood are hiding under a bed, saying, quote, "I recall being under the bed a lot because that was where I was safe." So, you know, the perfect evil soup. This is the soil that this little Albert man grew out of. And by age 12, Albert was already racking up some arrests, assault and battery, robbery. Like, he had a grand total of $2.85 on a robbery. He goes off to reform school, the Lyman School for Delinquent Boys. And he's in and out of that the whole time. The kid who would, like, this guy one day kind of was like, it became very clear in the boarding school that Albert DeSalvo was incredibly afraid of the dark, which is pure, in my mind, PTSD from growing up in a violent household.
If I lived with somebody who was beating my shit with a pipe, I would not trust the lights being off ever.
Sure. Right, exactly. He was terrified to walk alone at night. And then when he's going in and out and he tries to, like, actually straighten up for a little while, he joins the army at 17, partly, according to his brother, just to get the hell away from his stepfather, who was apparently just continuing to be violent. Didn't matter how old and how big this kid was getting. He did two tours and was honorably discharged both times. He gets posted out into Germany, where in 1949, he meets a young woman named Irmgard Beck. He marries her in 1953, and they have two kids together, daughter Judy, who was born with a hip disease, and a healthy son, Michael. In 1955, while stationed in New Jersey, Albert was arrested on a charge of carnally abusing a child. So while he was trying to get himself on the straight and narrow, very shortly after having his kids, he was
slipped up and sexually assaulted a child.
And sexually assaulted a kid.
His kids, the charge, or just a kid?
No, a different kid, slipping. Not his kids.
Just like a random kid?
Random kid. The charge was dropped later, and it's not something like worth like dwelling on all that much. But
right,
to show
right.
you,
like, let's move on. Let's just move on from
no,
that.
No, like, but like the point being, the general, like, as much as he is outwardly trying to fix himself and building a straight, like, go on the straight and narrow, quote unquote, the generational trauma and his own fucked up head and him being his own fucking asshole of a person is spilling out now, because now he's an adult.
Sexually assaulted a child.
Oh, exactly correct. Like, that's, you know, it's in the file. It's part of the who this dude was. And this is what makes Albert so hard to pin down, because everyone who actually knew the man brings up the same things first, that he smiled a lot. He was very sunny, lit up the whole damn room. Very, very friendly. This kinda is 1950s talk.
Yeah.
1950s talk. a little bit of Barry in the lead. And even the cops who arrested the guy, when they talked about him, remembered how nice of a guy he was. Obviously, and how he was smiling.
So much fried chicken to hand out. It was crazy.
He dressed up like a clown. So kids loved him.
It was hilarious. Loved him.
Everybody in the community saw him as like a devoted father. He built his nephew an elaborate wooden fort by hand. He wrote the kid letters telling him to mind his mother and study hard. His sister-in-law remembers nothing but sweet, quote, jaunty affection from him. And his old construction boss, when he heard Albert had confessed to being the Boston Strangler, was horrified, calling Albert a decent, kindly man who had never shown so much as a flicker of anything being wrong.
That's because that guy was old. That yeah. wasn't a child.
Point being is that everybody saw this guy as like this super nice dude, very friendly. But on the back end, he was also doing monstrous things and continuing to do the monstrous things his father had clearly done to them. You know, while he tried outwardly to be the opposite of his father, he was failing internally, privately. By the early 1960s, Albert's got the wife, the two kids. He's got steady construction work out in Malden, Massachusetts. And he's got a little side hustle he's a little con artist-y. Albert knocks on the, basically what he does is he knocks on the door of an attractive young woman, introduces himself as Johnson from the Black and White modeling agency, tells her she's got exactly the look they're casting for, and all he needs to do is take a few measurements. And so, again, he's super charming, boyish is a way he's also described. He's very disarming.
Modern pornography? Like, what are we talking about?
No. A ton of women were like, sure, come on in. And they, like, he just, like, measured their bodies. He'd thank them, tell them the agency would be calling them soon, and he'd leave the door. And that's it. That he was labeled by the cops as the measuring man.
The measuring man? Get that shit out of shit.
The measure of a man.
The measuring man.
Be measured by the man.
The measure. Oh, it's just the measuring man. Don't worry.
It's just like, it's sexual assault, I think, like, technically by
absolutely.
Law. Like,
absolutely,
like,
by, it
like,
is.
Like, that's what this is, no money or anything. He's literally going in and just measuring them with the tape measure and then being like,
I'm sorry. Are you trying to insinuate dude was doing it for the love of the game? Is that what you're saying? Like, it wasn't about money or getting rich. This guy was just being a creep to be a creep, dude.
I mean, kind of, right? Like, yeah, exactly, he's so correct. He's just being a creep to be a creep.
He just wanted to touch them titties.
Yeah. After he did it enough time, the cops came to know that he was, the Cambridge cops in particular, came to know that there was a guy out there doing it, and they just labeled him the measuring man.
The measuring man.
They caught him?
So goofy.
Yes, they do. In March of 1961, they finally catch him. And in a little detail that I love, they actually catch him mid-burglary, actually. And to their genuine surprise, this guy cheerfully cops to being the measuring man while he's at it. Like, they catch him robbing a place and they get him arrested. And while he's arrested, he's like, by the way, just want you to know, I'm also the measuring man.
You've probably been looking for me. I'm the measuring man. That's exactly what it sounds like.
Like, the cops say he was like
out there, but they haven't been measuring up.
Oh my god. Another awful Batman villain.
Yeah, Batman breaks in and just punches him in the face.
He's turning into the Riddler. Like, you're telling me, like, this guy, like, did all this and he just in jail decided that being the measuring man wasn't cool enough, so he wanted to be the Boston Strangler instead.
Well, you'll see. You'll see.
Alex, I'm being real with you. The measuring man is not cool enough. That is that is like a terrible villain. That's a terrible, like, to be the guy who's like, I'm notorious for measuring people.
What about you suck. Like, working on yourself, getting out of jail, and turning over a new leaf.
And the measuring man and the numbler.
Not for the measuring man. That's not
the
how
numbler?
He
do. Who the fuck is the numbler, dude?
It's a fucking fake Batman villain me and a couple friends made up a few nights ago.
Where he shows
up and he asks Batman, like, Batman, what's 6 + 4? And just as Batman's about to answer, he goes, doesn't matter. And he charges you. And that's his whole move.
He's the numbler, dude.
He's the numbler.
Okay.
It's dumb. I'm just saying, the measuring man belongs in the halls with, like,
the measuring man and the numbler are, like, perfect. Like, they're, like, right. They work right together.
And the only one who could stop the numbler, we determined, was a man by the name of Neutral Ted, who was never surprised by any of Numbler's charging actions.
What? All right.
We build lore, you know? We just build lore.
I get it. Lore, dude. Lore. Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand. Lore.
It's so Batman.
Yeah. It's like the worst Batman villain you could possibly think of. I think it came from Calendar Man came up at some point, and I was like, and then we just went from there. Anyway.
Condiment King, bro.
That's Condiment King. Is he an actual DC?
He's real. Sorry.
Him and Matter Eater Lad should come together and see
Matter
how that
Eater
goes.
Lad's terrifying. Condiment King's exactly what he sounds like.
I can't believe this one named Condiment King. That's fucking awesome. That's so dumb. Okay, anyway, he's in prison. He cheerfully tells the cops he's also the measuring man. Apparently, he's, like, delighted to tell them. And so he ends up serving about 11 months in prison after that. And by April of 1962, he is a free man once again. 2 months later is when the first Boston Strangler murder happens. So he's, like, just 2 months out of prison at that point. And while the whole city of Boston is beginning to lose their mind over the Boston stranglings, Albert is busy escalating into much worse than a tape measure. The cops working the suburbs north of Boston start tracking a brand new predator with a brand new nickname. He's not the measuring man. Now he's the green man. Named
He's just slowly becoming the Riddler. Is that what you're telling me?
Kinda, because he's nicknamed because he wears green pants.
Okay, so not the infamous full body green suit that has been featured in numerous TV shows and on the internet. Like, not that. Yes, not like that.
Like Joji.
Yes, yes, not that.
No.
Okay.
All right.
So the green man's methods, according to the cops, went like this. He would knock on the door, talk his way inside, say that there was a leak in the building and that he's like the superintendent or something here to fix it, go inside, and as soon as we let him inside, assault the person. Obviously, a lot worse than measuring man activity. He was starting to escalate.
Like, and rape him?
Wasn't full on rape at this point, but like grope, attack, pin, you know, just like force himself on them and in sexually assault them.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He's becoming a serial sexual predator at this point. Full stop.
Just
like that's what he is at this point. He's straight up like, this is not a guy. I don't want to frame it basically saying Albert DeSalvo is a man who got railroaded for doing nothing, like
They had evidence crimes and they associated one with the other. Sure.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, he would brag about this shit. By the time they would caught him for good in late 1964, he's tied to a long string of home invasion sexual assaults.
How does that even come up? By the way,
because his own bragging, he starts bragging. Like, literally, we're about to get to it. He brags when he gets caught, which is a lot, very serial killer kind of activity as well, bragging to hundreds of serial sexual assaults. And one of the assaults is massive for this particular night. June of 1964, where a woman named Virginia Thorner, Albert talks his way into her home, attacks her, holds a knife on her, and then he says something to her, something like that she would actually end up testifying to under oath. He tells her he'll kill her if she screams, and then he tells her exactly why she should believe him, because he's done this before. He says, quote, I've even gotten old lady, but they don't know it. End quote. Talking about him saying to her, like, I've killed an old woman. I'll kill you. It's not a big deal. We talked about back in part one, an 85-year-old Mary Mullen briefly.
Yep.
This is the one Albert later claimed died of a heart attack in his arms when he broke into her home, which this might be the one and only death in his whole saga of like his serial sexual assaults.
An accidental.
Potentially. Yeah, exactly. Jesse, were you about to ask something?
No, sorry. Just looking up more information. Just really.
Yeah.
What'd
you find?
Nothing yet. Literally just started looking. Mm. I'm genuinely and completely blown away by like just another example of. I don't know, man. Sometimes I question everything about society and about people. But I also know that if we, like, there must be good people because we keep catching bad people. Does that make any sense? Like, at some point, you have to see the good and like, well, you know, eventually they got him. But in this case, I don't know if they did, but they got a bad guy. But was it the bad guy? Like,
To John Bottomley and his psychic friend who got arrested by the FBI last episode for impersonating me.
Yeah. I'm still not okay with John Bottomley, dude. That's outrageous.
So late 1964, Albert is finally caught for good for the green man crimes, and he's shipped off to Bridgewater, the state hospital for the criminally insane, in the same lovely establishment we talked about last episode. Mm. And it's here at Bridgewater that our gentle con man meets the one kind of missing ingredient this entire legend needed to catch fire, man by the name of George Nassar. Now, George Nassar, who is this guy? Well, it depends entirely on who you ask. In the book that I used as the main source, gives a really good full spread of opinions as to who this guy actually is. So Ask his lawyer, and Nasser was a Sunday school teacher, a student of the Russian language, very bright with impeccable manners. Ask anybody else who knew the man, and you get a slightly different review. So one quote was a man of great anger. Somebody also said that the word around Bridgewater was that during the Charleston gang wars, George Nasser may have been personally responsible for 17 murders, maybe as high as 30. He's a retired Cambridge detective. And this is just, again, when I say, depending on who you ask, you get a different answer as to who this man is.
But he definitely was a retired detective, regardless of who you ask.
Yes, yes, yes. He was a retired detective. And calling Nasser the single scary. There was also an additional retired Cambridge detective who called Nasser the single scariest guy he'd ever heard of. And one inspector said of men like him, you shoot this guys like this guy first, and then you tell them to put their hands up, quote, end quote. Like, Nasser is a horrible person. He wasn't a detective. My bad. I was blanking on that. It's other detectives talking about him. And at 16 years old, George Nasser shot a shopkeeper four times during a stick-up, and his reasoning, in his own words, excitement. He got life for that one, and then got paroled, though, in 1961. And by 1960...
How long was he in jail?
At 16, he was in for years, like a decade.
Oh, my God. So first thing he did, he shot somebody in the chest four times.
Yeah, when he was 16.
And then got out of jail on good behavior, basically.
Got life in prison. Then in 1961, got paroled. And then by 1964, just 3 years out of his parole, he's right back inside. This time for, surprise, another murder. What? And now this man is Albert's new best buddy in Bridgewater Prison.
And when was he supposed to do those other 17 murders? Like, already by now?
Yeah, they're already done.
Wow.
And wouldn't you know it, George Nasser just so happens to have himself a lawyer. A young, famous, flamboyant, gun-carrying, flies his own plane, celebrity defense attorney by the name of F. Lee Bailey.
Stop.
This is the...
What? Okay. All right. Keep going, please.
This is the guy who just got, at this point in time, had just gotten Sam Shepard's conviction thrown out.
Yeah.
Jesse, you know who this guy is?
Yes. Very famous. Very famous criminal defense attorney.
What his face looks like.
Yes.
Yeah.
His license plate literally read trial. That is what his license plate on his car read.
Wasn't he like one of the OJ guys?
Yes. He defended O.J. Simpson, Patty Hearst, I think. But I also know he was disbarred in the early 2000s, and I'm trying to figure out for what. I don't remember what got him disbarred.
Well,
for mishandling nearly $6 million in stock owned by his client, Claude Louis de Bach.
Well, you win some, you lose some.
Well, now, here's how that this guy is in Albert's life, it almost becomes obvious how this is like the most famous confession for the Boston Strangler is the reason it hit the historical record. And I swear to you, like, this is so perfectly on brand for this show. It's insane.
I thought you were about to say his defense attorney, Johnny Cochran, but F. Lee Bailey is literally almost the same.
Yeah,
like thinking, like, wouldn't it be funny if you said Johnny Cochran? That'd be crazy. But it's like literally that's crazy to me.
I'm gonna have you guys. Who wants to be Bailey and who wants to be Nasser? Because basically, what we're looking at is a scene in the moment here where F. Lee Bailey, is sitting in a courthouse waiting for his client George Nasser when Nasser asks him a question, and this is how it all happened. I've got a little scene written out here right from the book. This is how freaking Albert DeSalvo even came into this guy's life with this very simple, straightforward conversation. Nasser, let's see, I'll dictate. Jesse, you can be Nasser, the guy who's in prison. Alex, you can be Bailey, the lawyer.
If a man was the strangler, the guy who killed all those women, would it be possible for him to publish his story and make some money with it?
It's perfectly possible, but I wouldn't advise it. I suspect that it would be the means by which the author would put himself in the electric chair.
I'll pass on the information. I promised this guy at Bridgewater I'd ask you.
What's the guy's name?
Albert DeSalvo.
With that brief conversation, Albert DeSalvo was now on George Nassar's radar, and things were about to get insanely crazy for the entire Boston Strangler case.
And it's like intent for like him confessing to a giant crime that he didn't do.
Yeah.
Also, like this shows why, like a reason why maybe he would do it right here, just yeah. based on the nature of this question.
Thank you so much to Mint Mobile for sponsoring today's episode. So here's a good one. When people hear that Mint Mobile plans are only $15 a month, the first thing out of everyone's mouth is, okay, yeah, well, what's the catch? And I get it, right? I ask the same exact thing, but there isn't one. No gimmicks, no gotchas, just unlimited talk, text, and data, fast, reliable coverage on the nation's largest 5G network, and an award-winning care team when you actually need a human being. I guess that makes Mint Mobile a catch, yeah? Mint took everything that's wrong with wireless and made it right. Premium wireless for $15 a month. You bring your current phone and your number, pick a 3, 6, or 12-month plan, and you can say goodbye to that monthly bill. Ditch the overpriced stuff. It's just so easy. You sign up online and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/chill. That's mintmobile.com/chill. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/chill. That's it. There's no catch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower than 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional tax, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Like, before Albert even says a single word to a single cop, two people are already discussing if money can be made on this. Mm-hmm. On the story like that. It's crazy that the first time it enters the record, really, the Boston Strangler is like because of money and not even because of the crimes.
When you said it was going to be a lawyer that we might recognize, I originally thought you were going to say Vincent Bugliosi from just the yeah,
okay.
And the JFK I can see that thing. And I was going to be like, no way. But now that it's this again, it's like you thought Johnny Cochran. I thought Vincent Bugliosi. This guy's like exactly the midpoint between those two men.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And now with and Nassar doesn't just like introduce them and then bow out either. Like, he personally delivers Albert to Bailey, and then he is in the room both times when the lawyer comes out to Bridgewater to interview Albert. Like, Nassar inserts himself into this shit. The two women connected to the case were brought out to Bridgewater to look at Albert in person to see if they were he was maybe their guy. The first was a woman named Marcella Loca, and she's going to come back. She was living at 315 Huntington Avenue in Sophie Clark's building, the same building that the same smooth-talking stranger had conned his way through on the very day Sophie Clark was murdered. So the same day Sophie Clark is strangled and killed in that building, he's also in there being Green Man and doing Green Man things. The second woman was Erica Wilson, who some cops believed had survived an attack by the Strangler himself. These two women looked at Albert DeSalvo, and neither one of them recognized him at all. Nothing. But there was another inmate in that room that day, and both women's heads turned to him. Both of them found this other man hauntingly familiar. Loca went on as far as to say that if his hair had been just a shade lighter, this man could have been the double of the stranger who had walked, who had came to her door the day of Sophie Clark died. And they're all talking about George Nassar because he's in the room with them. This is the fucking dude who was, we just like,
what the fuck?
I know.
So the cops are in the room with a witness who is looking at one dude and saying, actually, it's the other dude.
If his hair was a little lighter, she could have sworn it would have been him.
Was he there in the context of like a suspect? No.
No, he was there in the room with Albert DeSalvo and the lawyer at the time.
That is crazy.
It's so dumb. It's so stupid, dude. So like let's take a look at this for a second.
And the man who set up Nassar's just sitting there like
yeah. Yes is the answer. Yes.
Just correct. Covering his fucking face a little bit.
Yeah, just turning away. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, let's set this up real quick. The man who set the entire confession in motion, the man who stands to profit if Albert takes the fall, and the man who is physically sitting in the room while Albert is busy remembering if he was the strangler or not, and the man that two separate witnesses said looked exactly like the killer, all while the man doing the confessing looked like nobody had ever seen them in their lives, is sitting there. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that George Nassar was the Boston Strangler. Even the and even the source book doesn't ever go that far. But hold on to his name, because when we get to the end of the story, to the killers who walked away free while a dead con man took the bow, George Nassar is standing right there. Like, it is all, it is, to me, the shoes almost fit too well. Like, I'm almost willing to make that jump.
And I'm pretty sure you said Stranglers with a Z, so I know there's more than one out there anyway.
I did. Yeah, I did.
So maybe he's at least this woman's strangler, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, yeah. So if Albert DeSalvo didn't strangle these women, and remember, if it's the cops who actually worked these murders telling us he didn't, then we run into the first question of that breaks everybody's brains when they do all that, when they come into this case. Why in God's name would any man confess in graphic detail to 13 murders he did not commit? The book lays out a bunch of reasons, and we're going to go through a chunk of these right now.
Tell me he was terminal and he was best friends with Nassar.
No, he was not best friends with Nassar, unfortunately. Reason one, Albert's own lawyer, Bailey, had him convinced that the Green Man rape and sexual assault charges and robbery charges were going to put him away for life no matter what he did. Now, other legal experts have since said that this was complete nonsense, that Albert likely wouldn't have gotten anywhere near a life sentence on those charges, but Albert believed it, so in his head, his life is already over. The man has nothing to lose. Then there's reason two, the money. Albert was told that the rights to his life story, the confession, the whole Boston Strangler saga could be worth a fortune. And every cent of that fortune could go to his wife and kids, Irmgard and the kids, remember? And that's another reason he might want to do this. Then there's reason.
Legit like a good, caring dad?
Again, outwardly, yes. But
the kids?
They have mixed stories about the man. Of course he wasn't. Like, again, as with most people like this, the outward expression in the community and like the extended family almost feels more important to maintain that facade,
right,
rather than at the core home. Then there's reason three. Bailey supposedly convinced him that if he got himself branded as the Strangler, he wouldn't even go to prison.
What?
That he'd go to a nice, comfortable insane asylum, like a hospital. That Albert apparently had his heart set on John Hopkins Hospital, and that if he could get into it, this would be the best way to do it. So in his head, he'd be a sick man getting world-class treatment instead of a con doing hard time in prison. He'd be off in a nice prison, in a nice hospital. And then there's reason four, and the one that more or less explains everything else you'll ever learn about Albert DeSalvo. He just simply wanted to be somebody. This is a man whose single defining trait, and everyone who knew him also agrees on this, was that he had to be the biggest and the best at everything all the time. Oh, you did 20 burglaries? Well, I did 200 burglaries. The orderlies at Bridgewater said he drove the other inmates up a fucking wall with the constant one-upping and bragging that he would do with them. And Commissioner McNamara had an even simpler word for him. He just called him a blowhard. Like, this dude just wanted desperately to be somebody. So putting the whole recipe together, he basically, like, he's a pathological liar who's also kind of a born follower who genuinely believes he's going to go to prison no matter what. And that with money on the line and the ability to inflate his own reputation for good or bad leaves him with the only option. Confess to it all. He doesn't run from the part. He like auditions for this thing. So obviously, you know, like we all know, like, well, like, it's, but that's, I know it's like a crazy way to phrase it, but when you read about this and you really look into it, like, that's how he treated this shit. Like, there was not an ounce of seriousness in the actions between the three of these people together, between Albert Nassar and like Bailey. Like, yeah, they were doing it, but it was just, it was like three people trying to con each other.
Yeah, it feels to me like it's people trying to make money off this dude and then sell him a bill of goods about how, like, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. It's okay. You'll go to, like,
a
country club, man. It'll be fine. Just, you know, but, like, let us make money off of you, though, dude.
Exactly. And this is before inmates couldn't make money off of it themselves. Like, he could take that money and give it to his wife and kids. And we talked about it last episode, but remember, too, the you know, a lot of people are like, well, he knew all the details. One of the first things we talked about last episode, we'll reiterate this episode. Albert had a fucking photographic memory. Like, the doctors tested it. Dr. Robbie actually tested this, and he walked Albert through a room full of staff members, brought him back the very next day after everybody had changed clothes and switched seats, and Albert reconstructed the original scene perfectly. Every person, every outfit, every chair, exactly the way it was when he saw it the previous day. Quote, absolute, complete, 100% total photographic recall. So like, it's one of those things where it's like, of course he has all this shit because he has memory of it. For one, the pipeline of the newspapers. But we're going to repeat it. The Boston Press printed fucking everything. The robe, the cord, the blood in the ear, wine bottle, the belt that broke mid-strangling, all that stuff was sitting right there in the Boston Globe, the Traveler, the Herald, for any person to read.
So then it wasn't that big of a deal.
No, and then remember part two, the other pipeline to it is the worksheet. They fucking published the Strangle worksheet. Right. In the Record American. The
tutorial, yeah.
Get the literal tutorial on how to do all of this. And then the other part, there were leaks like crazy on this case. Like, this shit was leaking everywhere. The medical examiner, Dr. Ford, was handing out copies of autopsy reports at press conferences, remember? Like, we briefly talked about that too. Like, there was infinite ways.
Why were you doing that? That's crazy.
Because this shit was mishandled from moment one. Like, this is a spectacular case of political everybody theater,
like, ruining this case.
Exactly. Like, this is an exemplary example of just complete fuckery from bottom to top with everybody involved trying to, quote unquote, solve this shit. One detective even walked in and found State House office pages passing the crime scene photographs around. We talked about it last week, remember? And like, we're trading them around with each other like look fucking baseball cards.
Oh, yuck. Look at that.
Yeah. Then we have another pipeline in Albert's own legwork. When Dr. Robbie asked Albert how on earth he knew the layouts of the victim's apartments, Albert basically shrugged and said it was easy, that he'd been so fascinated by the murders that he went out and then toured the crime scenes himself. He would even let himself in the areas where he could get into the crime scenes. I guess he burgled. Yeah, he burgled all the time. He broke in constantly if he couldn't talk his way in.
Fucking weird.
Then there's the hypnotist angle. The lawyer brought in a hypnotist who put Albert under, and by the account of the people who actually watched these sessions, proceeded to feed him an entire theory, leading him in the hypnosis sessions, telling him the victims were stand-ins for his wife and daughter.
What?
Even Gerald Frank, who was the author who believed Albert was guilty, admitted the witnesses came away wondering just how much Albert was being led on by the hypnotist. Like, this lawyer did everything to muck up.
So it's only, this is like true, like history is written by the victors type shit, where like,
oh yeah,
at every
and it step, worked,
it just looks shit, and then like, but in, if you zoom out far enough, it just looks like an open and shut case.
Yes, it worked for decades, dude. Decades before this shit even came out to the public. And then another one, when Albert finally sat down to give his official confession, the man taking it down, John Bottomley, obviously, kept feeding Albert the answers himself. Like,
what do you mean?
And you don't need to take my word on this either. We're going to prove it. Don't worry. Like, because the confession itself turns out it's the single best piece of evidence that Albert was never actually the fucking strangler in the first place. So we have 54 hours of confessions on tape. That's how long Albert's recorded confession ran.
And we're going to read it all.
54. Yeah. This is the thing that convinced the public that this was all rock solid, that this is the bedrock the entire legend stands on at this point. Now, you would expect the killer's confession to be a flood of details nobody else on earth could possibly know. Albert's is the polar opposite. This guy is very clearly fishing, guessing, and getting fed the answers by the man fucking interrogating him. And we, like, again, you don't take my word for it. We've got transcripts of this. So we can look a little bit at some of these transcripts here. We'll go ahead, and this is a brief back and forth between Albert and Bottomley. Who wants to be Bottomley and who wants to be Albert?
I've always come across as a Bottomley.
We've got a few different little pieces here to read, and they are brief. But here's one interaction.
The type of blue robe she had on was like a cloth. You know what I mean?
Flannel?
Yeah. Oh, well, flannel if you want it. Cotton.
Cotton.
Immediately, he's fishing for details, and Bottomley just gives him answers, and it just would, yeah, oh, well, yeah, 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 flannel, or if you want it, like, cotton, immediately. We also have another one that's back and forth here that I'm going to go ahead and give you guys. Here we go. Just little brief moments where you could see there's, like, a break in his, like, logic here.
The inside, on the inside, do you remember?
As far as I can remember, blue.
You don't remember any different color?
No.
That's important. That little exchange is important because the lining was red. Like, we have the autopsy report plain as day written out. And if this man has a true photographic memory,
he would remember.
He would have remembered because he would have been there. The newspaper worksheet had described the outer robe as blue, but never described the inner lining. So evidence that he looked at the newspaper, but maybe, you know, wasn't actually there. Then Bottomley asks him about a wastebasket in the kitchen. There was one, and its contents had been dumped out across the floor, which was a detail that was never printed anywhere. And Albert simply cannot see it. It's not in his memory. He wasn't, because it was never in the fucking papers. And then we get to the exchange that would be pure, honestly, like fucking comedy if it weren't bolted to like this horrible shit. They're trying to nail down in this exchange exactly when one of the victims, Nina Nichols, died. And Albert, the man with a certified photographic memory confessing to a murder he supposedly committed with his own two hands, can't do it. He doesn't know the date. He does not know how many days are actually in the month of June. He says, quote, I'd say June 30th, if it's on a Saturday. He doesn't know if it's even on a Saturday or not. He's reading, as he's doing these questions, he's reading Bottomley's like face and then adjusts his answer back and forth between, like, he'll say if it was a Saturday. And then if he gets corrected, be like, oh yeah, that's what I meant. It's a Sunday.
You think the cops were just like, boys, let's just let this be over today. What do you guys say? Let's just go in there.
That's how it feels.
And give him the right answers. And then he'll be the one. And then we just all go get a beer.
Yeah, and it keeps going, too. He mixes up which year the murders happened in. Bottomley keeps having to hand him the dates, the sequence, the details. And Albert keeps gratefully accepting every single one of the details and folding it back into his memory, with air quotes. Like, it was always, he always remembered it. He had just forgotten for a moment. And when it came to the victim, Mary Sullivan, the 19-year-old, the famous last victim who had gotten posed and moved around in the house, he didn't even remember that the body had been moved to from the bed to another place. He blanked. He had no explanation for that. No idea that that even happened. So again, he doesn't have any of these fucking details that he would need for him to match what the police know beyond the stuff that was publicly reported in the newspaper. Susan Kelly's verdict on this, which is the author of the book, she says that it's basically virtually exonerates DeSalvo from these Boston Strangler crimes specifically. And honestly, I don't see how she's wrong here. We'll go into the details of like the one person he may have actually killed momentarily, but like
the old lady.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to go into that here in a minute. But like these tapes, the public did not get to see or hear these tapes for decades. Only short, cleaned up, doctored versions of these ever saw the light of day.
Literally,
like edited, like little edited parts where parts were taken out to make it sound like getting fished for answers. Yeah, exactly. And then March 18th, 1965, while Albert is already locked up inside Bridgewater, a 50-something chambermaid named Effie McDonald is found strangled to death in a hotel room in Bangor, Maine. Two stockings around her neck, dress ripped open, all the stuff that fit the Boston Strangler. The Strangler may very well have still been out there working while the man who claimed to be the Strangler was sitting in a fucking cell. Like, the dude is in prison and there's still murders that match the Strangler happening in New England.
They're actually like on him.
Yeah, and you know what the final gut punch about all this fucking is? Ready? Albert DeSalvo was never tried for a single one of those murders.
Why?
They couldn't do it. There wasn't a fingerprint. There wasn't a witness. There wasn't one single solitary shred of physical evidence placing him at a single one of these strangling cases. Because remember, they had partial fingerprints for some of them. He doesn't match anything. They have nothing other than his confession. What they actually tried him for in 1967 were the Green Man crimes, the rapes, sexual assaults, and robberies. And for that trial, Bailey ran a defense strategy so cynical, it loops all the way back around on all this stuff. Bailey's grand plan was to stand up in open court and brand his client the Boston Strangler.
It's such it's an insane, it's like a publicity stunt.
Yes. This whole thing sucks. Like, it's insane. For him, for Bailey, the logic went, if the jury believes this man is a 13-time monster, then they'll have to find him not guilty by reason of insanity on the rape charges, because who but a complete lunatic does all of that? And then the judge ships him off to a hospital instead of a prison. You get your own client declared the most evil man in the state of Massachusetts, and in doing so, save him from a cell. That was the play, which is, as Jesse just said, extremely just a publicity stunt. It's just all publicity stunt.
Did the lawyer even think he was going to win? I don't think so.
That wasn't the point for the lawyer. Yeah. The lawyer was to become known for defending the most evil man in Massachusetts, and then that he saved him, because that means other people are willing to pay big money for all the horrible things that they want him to cover for.
So crazy. But also, yeah, I don't want to spoil the ending, but a lot of people involved in this end up getting in trouble much later in life for other equally dramatic crime things. So, like,
well, we might talk. I don't know if we'll talk about everybody, so you can keep some updates on hand. But like, this particular idea to get him charged as the Boston Strangler backfired completely. Sure. The jury found Albert guilty on the Green Man charges, and the judge, apparently quite convinced by Bailey's own argument that this was a profoundly dangerous human being, sentenced Albert to life in prison. Bailey's reaction to losing is a very simple quote. He said, "Massachusetts has just burned another witch." That was what the lawyer's reaction to this was. So
very whack.
Off Albert goes
to invoke that for this reason.
Yeah. Albert goes, ships off to Walpole, maximum security. And it's here and is where, like, in this prison is the final stretch of his life that things get a little weird, because before the end of it all, Albert recanted. He took the whole thing back, said he wasn't the Boston Strangler after all. And then on November 25th, 1973, the night before he was murdered, Albert made a frightened phone call to his old Bridgewater psychiatrist, Dr. Ames Robbie. About a week before this call, Albert had gotten himself moved into the prison infirmary under a special lockup, like a man who knew something was coming for him. He tells Robbie on the phone that he needs to meet immediately and that Robbie should bring a reporter with him, because Albert was finally going to tell the real story, who the Boston Strangler actually was and what this entire thing had really been about. Robbie told him he'd come in the morning, but that night, Albert DeSalvo was stabbed to death in his cell.
That really happened?
Yep.
And now, everybody still thinks this guy did it?
Well, I'm not going to be like, and the truth was silenced forever, blah, blah, blah. No, Robbie absolutely believed Albert was killed to keep him quiet in a dead men tell no tales kind of way. But there was a flatter, kind of just like uglier theories that could put on the table. One was a prison drug deal just went wrong and he got stabbed for it. It's very simple as that. Or, and there's a theory that comes from George Nassar himself, of all people, a dispute over a black market meat that Albert was selling on the inside, and three inmates he was selling meat that he was getting smuggled in, and like he was selling it on the side.
I don't want to know how.
I don't know. Three inmates were eventually charged with his murder. Not one of them was ever convicted. So kind of like, just like his own victims, his own murder remains unsolved to this day. He died at 42 years old, having spent his final years signing autographs and selling letters to serial killer memorabilia collectors. because there's a ton of weirdos like that. I as much as I love true crime, no interest in having like serial killer memorabilia. It's crazy. I went to one weird witchy market once, and there was a table that's like they sold the dirt scooped up from like John Wayne Gacy's like found home foundation or whatever. I'm like, why?
It separates the men from the Bagans, baby.
Yeah, I guess so. So for 30 years, Albert's death and the doubt like was kind of the closed book. But his legend grew. And by the year 2000, the family of Mary Sullivan, who was the final victim, decided they were done waiting around for actual answers. They wanted to clear Albert's name because they didn't believe that he was the one that killed them. And at the very least, finally find the truth and maybe find somebody, the actual perpetrator of these crimes. So they had Mary's body exhumed. And a famous forensic pathologist named Michael Baden performed a full re-autopsy on her, an 8-hour procedure. And what he found seemed to blow Albert's confession wide open. Albert had claimed that he knocked Mary unconscious with a blow to the head before strangling her. Baden found no sign of skull trauma whatsoever. And on top of that, the private team recovered DNA, what appeared to be male genetic material from near Mary's body. And it did not match Albert DeSalvo. I know.
I thought it was going to be like a lot more like, you tell me, but it really is not. It's really like the dude was like, I didn't do this. They,
yeah, that's literally it. He got fucking shanked. And this is like a high watermark for every single thing that we've talked about, honestly. Then the year 2001, independent forensic testing, and the science seems to be saying it loud and clear. Somebody else was the culprit here. The family's own lawyer actually just said it flat out. Somebody else was there. They were the ones that did it. For everyone else who had spent decades believing Albert was innocent, this was total vindication for them, knowing that there was other people out there who were actually the ones who killed their family members. And if we had recorded this back in 2002, that's exactly where it would have ended. But the state had something the family didn't. The Boston police had preserved physical evidence from the original 1964 crime scene. Seminal fluid recovered the very day Mary was murdered, sitting quietly in storage for 50 fucking years. And by 2013, the technology had finally caught up to it.
What are you about to say?
Investigators couldn't just legally walk up and grab Albert's DNA. So instead, they put surveillance on Albert's nephew. They followed the man around. And when he tossed a water bottle, an officer trained in surveillance scooped it up and they pulled the family's DNA right off of the bottle. They compared the nephew's DNA against the 50-year-old crime scene sample. Familial match.
What?
Familial match.
They, brother.
Close enough of a match that they got a court order to dig up Albert himself. So, July 12th. 2013, they exhumed Albert DeSalvo from a cemetery. Huh?
Which murder is this?
Mary, I think, was the final one.
Okay.
They exhumed Albert DeSalvo from a cemetery in Peabody, took a direct DNA sample from his remains, and it compared it against the seminal fluid preserved from Mary Sullivan's bed in 1964. It matched. And I don't mean probably matched. The DA's office, the attorney general, and the Boston police put out a joint statement with an actual number attached to it. Basically, the odds that some other man, not Albert DeSalvo, left the evidence at Mary Sullivan's murder scene, 1 in 220 billion, that it was someone else that wasn't DeSalvo who killed Mary Sullivan.
So
the 2001 test didn't match. 2013 test matched. So how do you square that circle?
Yeah.
Right? And that's what we're trying. Like we're doing the exact same thing we just spent two episodes accusing the legend makers of doing, right? So like here's an honest answer. The 2001 sample came off of Mary's body after it had been embalmed, buried, and decomposing for 36 years. The head of Boston's own crime lab called the evidence very questionable. The 2013 match came from biological evidence that had been properly preserved by police since the literal night of the murder. They were very two different testing methods and testing for two different things. And only one of them was clean.
Not like an easy thing to accidentally do, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So like talking about this, honestly, like where does that leave us? Because the easy version of this, is like basically the cops were right. There was no single strangler and Albert was an innocent man as far as most of these particular crimes are concerned. Except but the DNA wrecks it because Albert DeSalvo did do that one, at least one of them. He raped and strangled the 19-year-old Mary Sullivan in her apartment on Charles Street 4 days after she moved to the city.
Did he do the tying and the, did he like set it up and everything?
Yeah, he did it. And so, here's the thing. We know for certain he did that.
All right. And that's what I was just looking up. So we know at least from DNA evidence that he did that one.
And this is the one, as we said in the beginning, it was the last one. And it was the one that was elaborately set up for a cop to walk into. And it was like the body was on display, but it didn't have the signature signs. Like there was something tied around her neck after the fact. She didn't like die from her tights being around her neck. The cop said there was no probable relationship between who killed Mary Sullivan and the likely Boston Strangler. Mm-hmm.
So this was you mentioned before, and I can't remember how many were copycat-ish?
The public. So there's about five or so that were copycat-ish. There was a good eight or nine that were the actual, what could be pointed to as like an individual person
and
doing
that's
it.
Kind of what people feel like Albert was, is just like one of the extra murders.
One of the extra murders who came through basically. Yeah.
And he wanted to have done all of them instead.
Yeah. Either bragging it or convinced to say it. That's unfortunate. Unfortunately, where the hell that leaves us is with not a clean answer. It's not like one or the other. It was him or wasn't him. It's fucking both. The DA who announced the DNA match was also very careful to say out loud that the match applies only to Mary Sullivan and nobody else. The other 10 women, different ages, remember 19 all the way up to 85, different races, different religions, different methods entirely, some strangled, some stabbed, one was beaten, different knots for God's sake, like not one shred of physical evidence tying Albert to a single one of them other than the Mary Sullivan case.
So the stranglers with a Z is we have one guy who killed this one woman, and then there are other dudes who probably killed other women, but then there's also the Boston Strangler who's just out there in the ether still.
The probable truth is that there was no single Boston Strangler. It was so mishandled from murders one and two that the details were out in the public so fast that copycats could have happened immediately. Sure. There was no attempt at keeping this under wraps. And then it was mishandled from fucking Bottomley to the psychic, everybody around that. I think the cops were right on the fact that there was no single Boston Strangler all along and that the city itself kind of got swept up in separate horrors that they all tried to tidy into one clean thing. So they had like a monster they could put their worries too, because the opposite is way more stressful. Yeah. And at the very same time, Albert DeSalvo did commit horrible, heinous crimes even prior to the single murder. And he didn't lie about being a killer. He lied about being the killer. Sure. But he didn't lie about being a killer. Like he was a murderer.
All the insane he wasn't the killer, but he was a killer.
Yeah. And then there's George Nassar.
Hold on. Mathis?
Sure. Yeah.
Now, I am not, Alex is more of a writer than I am, but I think Alex would even admit that if you're about to tell us that there was some sort of Bailey-Nassar conspiracy, and that Nassar, who was already in prison, is in some way related to these murders, I'm going to lose my shit.
Keep in mind.
I'm going to lose my shit. It's like a written mystery.
I slipped in.
The woman recognized him down to the...
I slipped in a small detail when I brought up NASA initially.
That's what I'm saying. If you're about to tell us that this guy was actually involved...
Well, one...
No! This is a movie script.
Witnesses,
this is insane.
The two surviving witnesses said that he actually looked like the man that attacked them, and they are believed to be survivors of a Boston Strangler attack. Investigators did actively wonder about George Nassar for years. Nassar himself went to his grave denying every bit of it, and he died in a prison hospital in 2018 at 86 years old.
This man
never once charged with a single strangling, insisting in his very last interview they had nothing to do with any of it.
Are you telling me there's the potential that of the stranglers with a Z, Nassar, who worked with F. Lee Bailey, a corrupt ass dude, to try and get Albert to take the rap for all this, the two of them could make a buck, actually may have been in some way associated.
It may actually be the case that George Nassar was, in fact,
the real one. You're saying not just the side guy, the actual real one? Stop.
It may be the actual real strangler all along.
No way. What? That's crazy.
Because he was free for the years that he was out there. He was free when the stranglings were mainly happening.
And somebody again, who he tried to kill recognized him.
Yeah, isn't it strange how the one person who he was very, very close with, who was calling his doctor saying, I need safety, I need to tell you the truth about it all, the only person who would Nassar maybe have told it would have gotten stabbed before he could say anything?
This is
Jesse.
This is like, I can't, like, this is like the end of The Usual Suspects. This is like a level of plot twist that is absolutely blowing my, like, you even set it up earlier, and not until you was ended with like, and then this Nassar thing, I was like, bro, what? So this guy
now, yeah, now re-examine the first time they meet. Re-examine the first time Nassar brings in Albert to meet the lawyer after the first interaction between Nassar and his lawyer saying, so what do you think you think you can make money with the story of the Boston Strangler? Now, you can't really enjoy that money if you're the one claiming to be the Boston Strangler. You're going to get put away for life. But if you can get somebody to claim they're Boston Strangler, and then maybe the lawyer dirty deals and gives you a chunk of the change for introducing the two of you in a nice little finder's fee.
They're like, I got this guy who loves to lie.
But then, after a good few years in prison, decades in prison, it's weird. Maybe Albert doesn't really like prison all that much. And maybe this was a mistake. I should recant all this and maybe tell the truth to somebody I can trust. The one doctor I know who tested me and like I could trust. I'll call him and we'll start to remember he told the psychiatrist to bring a reporter. Bring a reporter. I'm going to tell you the truth. And the night before the night of the phone call, he gets stabbed to death. Three prisoners get charged. None of them get convicted. Everybody goes free. Nobody finds out who the actual Boston Strangler is. And meanwhile, George Nassar dies at 86 years old in prison, never really knowing a life out of prison in the first place, except for 4 years where he could have actively been the Boston Strangler.
That is the thing that's frustrating about this to me is how famous the Boston Strangler is and how clearly we kind of. Like, is there not like a Netflix about this?
There must be.
I mean, there is a movie, but not. I don't think to. I don't know
there's
if there's anything that dives
like
into this.
Making a murderer about this.
I don't think there is.
Like, this is crazy. This is a crazy story.
It's insane.
It's true. It's like you know that. There was that like TikTok like song.
Yes,
that plays
like
when
yes.
The plan is revealed. That's like what's going on right now.
Yeah.
The last time there was a documentary was there was a Nat Geo one in March of 2025. It's 44 minutes long. And I don't think, and it's just, and the picture is just Albert DeSalvo on the thumbnail.
And it's not called like the Boston Strangler a lie, the perfect lie.
No, it's called the Real Boston Strangler. But I to be fair, I didn't watch this.
I'm just, I'm just mind blown that there's not like, it's not in common knowledge that there's this crazy conspiracy here.
No, I think it's because I think by the time the conspiracy came out, it was so far beyond the crimes. More, decades later, most people don't care anymore.
It's more sensational than the fucking crimes. There's plenty of crime. There's plenty of like serial killers out there, but how many of them are like a weird conspiracy?
Exactly. And that's where we leave the episode on the Boston Strangler boys. That's we don't get crazy. A clean ending. I, while the author may not be able to, may be willing to make that jump, I'm willing to, I would put money that George Nassar was in fact involved with the crimes while he was free. And this whole thing set up from the very beginning from him and Bailey, a famous fucking lawyer. I know. I just, Jesse's, for people who are audio, Jesse's jaw has been open. He's like,
I only like, realized when you paused and I realized my mouth has been open for like, I don't even know how long. I am dumbfounded by this. This is like, even look, I've said this before when we talk about different stories that people write in or whatever, even if I don't believe it, the audacity of the storytelling is like, literally, like, cause they're so sick. Like, we're at that point where like a man scammed everyone and got away with it technically, even though he was in prison. Sort of. Like, it's
but he's rich, maybe.
I don't know. I'm more interested. Well, again, I would say there's probably an Effley Bailey angle on this, but
he would make him. He would make him a portion of the proceeds on the story.
I mean, that, I'm like, again, that guy. He was so disbarred. He tried to get rebarred, I think, in Maine. And Maine was like, no, bro. Like, that's how bad it was for Effley Bailey. So, like, I don't – like, man, that's crazy.
While I can't say for certain that George Nassar was, in fact, him and it all got set up, I will simply say it is certainly coincidental how all this played out.
Because of the timeline, I guess it could fit. But also – I think the big takeaway should be that the number one thing that happened was that the police released too much information, which then allowed people who were, you know, all sorts of crazy to commit crimes that look the same. And then to have that sort of like, yes, I am the strangler. You know, like.
Yep.
Going back to Albert, the idea of wanting to feel important, to feel like you're special, to feel like you did something in life. And sometimes it's crazy. Like, oh man, what is the name of that show? Death by Lightning. Hey, if you want to see a version of this play out, there's a Netflix show. Back when I still had Netflix, it is called Death by Lightning, and it's about the assassination of James Garfield. But it's the two main characters is one, James Garfield, but then two, the guy who kills him. And you can see this dude sort of transform from like, I want to be someone to I'm going to be someone for the president to the president doesn't want me around. So I guess I'll just kill the president. And that will get me. And he like loves the idea of that's how he'll be remembered.
Yep. It's a mental illness.
Yeah.
It's self-importance.
Yeah. Like they live with the dream that I'm going to do something. And eventually that I'm going to do something morphs into, well, I'm going to do something terrible. And that's how I'll be remembered.
And Albert DeSalvo for this situation too, like his past, his history, how he was raised, he fits the profile of a monster so easily that, like you said, when you zoom out, when the police provide only tidbits here and there, and they're like, we've got him.
He definitely is a fucking monster. He's a piece of shit.
You could see how if the police were like, we got him, here's our guy, everybody's like, oh, it makes sense that he's your guy. He's the green man. He's the measuring man. You know, like, obviously, he's
on the city's biggest villains.
Exactly. Like, so they can just put it away. And then decades later, when the records fully come out and you see this whole George Nassar, Lee Bailey, like, situation, you're like, wait, what? And it all just falls. It just all falls apart. Like it's insane. It's insane.
I already was mad for like one reason, and then you hit me with the other thing, and I was like, you know, I kind of expected it, but I'm also furious because it is like Jesse's saying, it's like straight up.
It's conspiracy
an episode
shit.
Of a TV
yeah,
show.
It feels like.
Yeah, I'm glad you feel that way. Yeah, I felt the same.
It feels like an actor should come out. You know, it like. It's like an episode of The Blacklist or some shit. It's like so over the top, and it's like criminality and like mastermind Moriarty-esqueness.
By the way,
it's crazy.
It was me the whole time. Yeah.
I was always, yeah, he's on his deathbed. I was always the Boston Strangler. And it's just that it's like the cherry on top is him getting stabbed the night before he was supposed to tell the truth, quote unquote.
That's fucking crazy, bro.
And on that, boys, is our two-parter on the Boston Strangler / Stranglers. We'll be we're off to go do a Minnesota. You both are just shaking your head. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode.
Go buy shirts. Go buy stickers. Go buy posters. Go buy tickets.
Live show tickets, all that stuff. Yeah, patreon.com/ Chilluminati Pod as well. We're off to go to a Minnesota right now, as you get one every single week. And we'll decompress about the conspiracy that I tossed on these boys' shoulders in the last minute.
Insane.
Thank you all so much. And we'll see you next time. Appreciate you. Love you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Chilluminati Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by the... I don't know who they are. There's two.
What?
Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer.
No.
Neo and Trinity.
No.
I don't understand, and I probably never will. Let me just tell you right now that there's two. Leon Kennedy and Claire Redfield.
I'm telling you, I think he literally just looked up famous duos.
Cheech and Chong.
And it's been going through the list ever since.
I'm trying to dig deep. Which one of you is Dick Powell?
Me?
Your name's Jesse Cox.
I want to love you. I want my
to the Chilluminati Podcast. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by Alex and Jesse. Like a shooting star across the sky that's actually a UFO.